What I have to say is largely going to apply to nonfiction books, which, as you know, most of you are sold on proposal, not on a full manuscript. Some of what I have to say is about the business of publishing, and it might be useful to others as well. But the goal in all of this is to give you a sense for the business side of publishing. So I'm not going to read any of your manuscripts today. I'm not judging any of you as people. I'm just giving you the ugly nuts and bolts of the publishing industry. And basically, my goal is to get you really depressed. Because publishing is a disaster. Nobody's buying books. Nobody's paying. Anyway, long story. What I want to do is get you really, really depressed, and then we're going to take a break. And those of you that come back after the break, then I'm going to try to build you back up again. Not in a giddy sense of infinite possibility, but hopefully with a set of skills and ideas and understanding that'll give you at least a decent chance of succeeding the way you want to. So, if you'd like to leave now and avoid the emotional crush, feel free to do that. Let's talk about the industry, which is basically everything other than this magical red arrow. The only two people that count are the author and the reader. The rest of us are sucking your souls and your dollars. And anybody who pretends otherwise is full of it. That we need to be adding some value to the process, otherwise the percentage we take at every step along the way is not worth it. So what's happening over time with digital, as is true in every of the creative fields, this flow of value of work between author and reader is getting constantly disrupted. The traditional model, since not Gutenberg, but since the 1800s, has been from an author through critique and edit. And I have this as a separate step. It's not the industry step, but whether you're in a writing group or whether you have a writing buddy or you hire an editor, hopefully none of you is out there writing alone. So how many people here are in a writing group? How many people here have some kind of writing buddy that's not someone they love? All right, the rest of you have your homework. That I do not take on clients who aren't getting systematic professional feedback. By professional, I don't mean they're paying for it necessarily, but from somebody who's smart and thinks about writing as a profession, who's giving you good feedback on how to make your work better. You guys remember a book called Kite Runner? I don't remember the millions that it sold, but every page of that was workshopped at an art gallery on the second floor above Union Square in San Francisco. It's good enough for him, it's good enough for you. His new book, the same, was constantly critiqued. So the best writers out there are getting their work out to people who can give them thoughtful, useful feedback. And I always say get in a writing group because you're also going to get better by you giving your feedback to other people. Yes? Okay, let's see if we can do this.
We will try the mic.
There's so many mics there. This is a panel room.
Right. It's like, just pick a mic.
Can you hear me? Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like Frank Sinatra. So get in a writing group. You need to be getting systematic feedback. So that's step two, is critique and edit. And then it goes to an agent. Not that agents aren't going to edit as well. Hopefully we're giving you lots of good feedback. This is the chain, and this is where you have your work, your proposal and your sample chapters and so on, ready to go to publishers. So then our job is to sell it on to the acquisitions editor. It's a different kind of editor. They're, on one level, Procter & Gamble marketing managers. On the other, they can be really brilliant editors. And the whole rap that editors don't edit anymore, for some it's true, for others it's not true. And there's still some brilliant editors in the publishing houses. Their job, then, is to sell it on to their sales and marketing team. And you'll notice a theme, selling. Everybody is selling on to the next person in this chain. So what the acquisitions editor does is they say to the agent, I love this book. I want to acquire it for our publishing imprint. But then they've got to persuade their sales and marketing folks that it does have the commercial prospects they think it does. They in turn sell it on to their publisher. They sell it into the distributors and the retailers. Not every book appears at Barnes & Noble. Every book may appear on Amazon theoretically, but it's not going to be featured in the same way. There's a lot of work involved in here in getting a book showcased and pitched and distributed in the right ways. And then the retailers are selling it on to readers. There's also a pull. You know, if a reader has heard about your work, they're going to order it on Amazon. They're going to go to the Barnes & Noble and looking for it. But in addition, there's that push function. So at every step along this way, it's folks trying to sell on to the next person. Like every agent, I get calls pretty frequently from editors who are leaving publishing, the editing role, whether they're getting fired or laid off or because they just don't want to do it anymore. And they say, well, I'm thinking about becoming an agent. And I'll ask the question, great, how do you feel about sales? And some of those, oh, what do you mean sales? That's what agents do. We sell for a living. And in certain ways, that's what everybody else has to do, and that's what you've got to do. So hopefully it's not Willy Loman-esque, but you are in sales and understand that and be comfortable with that. So let me talk about the big picture now of the industry. This is the flow from author to reader. Let's now zoom out 30,000 feet or more to the big picture of the industry and talk about nonfiction. These are basic trends for nonfiction that I've got in the outline here that are the main categories. What you need to do as you start to pitch your book to any next level in this crazy chain is to explain two things. What kind of book is it? And which shelf does it go on? They're related, but they're not quite the same thing. So first is, what is it? Is it a narrative? And far too often we see proposals that say, oh, you know, my narrative X, Y, and Z, and they just mean that it was one word, then the next word, then the next. That's not narrative. Narrative is story. And not to be trite and not to belittle anybody's project, but the first question is, okay, what's the plot? What would the movie be? If you can't tell me what the movie might be, then there really isn't a narrative here. That's history, it's biography, it's current affairs, it's something where there is actual storytelling. Second category is self-help, news you can use. That could be a cookbook, could be a business book, could be health, it could be a variety of different things, but it's lots of good information. Now, in the internet age, that actually changes, because first thing you do when you have a personal need is, really nowadays we go to the web. So what makes a self-help book work now and is necessary now more than in the past is that it's got to be telling, to some extent, a story, but rather think of it as a program, step by step. So cookbooks, it's not just, hey, here's a collection of recipes, because anybody can go to Epicurious for that on the web. What it's got to be is, hey, I'm going to teach you from beginning to end how to master the art of Thai cooking or whatever else, or how to put on a great dinner party. Or if you have a health situation, my dad got brain cancer a number of years ago. First step, we went to the web. We wanted to know everything about it. Then we went looking for the books that would explain step by step what is this process going to be like. So there's room still for books, but they've got to be framed for nonfiction, practical nonfiction, in a way that tells a story that builds to the information sequentially so that the reader is that much more knowledgeable at the end. The last category is a weird one, which is getting a bit long in the tooth, and that's concept histories. Sometimes called books about nouns. Hopefully it's about a noun that changed the world. That whole realm started with Longitude. How many people read Longitude by David Sobel? Yeah, it's not as popular these days. But it was basically about the birth of the chronometer back in, I think, the 1700s. And she wrote a biography of an object, essentially. Since then, as you see with just a few of the examples I put down here, there has been basically a book written about every single noun that exists. Every color, every body part, every foodstuff. So if any of you can think of a noun about which a book hasn't yet been written, please come see me after class, because there's potential. There's even, no joke, a coffee table book about coffee tables. So that's the ultimate meta point. So those are the three areas, types of books. What are you writing? I'm writing a narrative, or I'm writing a self-help book, or I'm writing a concept history, which is more rare in this day and age. And then, what shelf does it go on? I had someone pitch me today, and I apologize if this person is in the room because I'm going to make fun of you, who said it's going to go on this shelf and that shelf. And no, it's not. When a book is stocked at a Barnes & Noble or your great independent bookseller, it's going on one shelf. So it's like that old joke in Monty Python that it's a dessert topping and a foot ointment. pick one, please. Either one's plausible, but pick one. And so if your book is Parenting meets X meets Y, whatever, you know, that's out of the player, the old movie. It's Titanic meets The Joy of Cooking. Okay. But tell me, is that going to go on the adventure or history shelf, or is it going to go on the cookbook shelf? It's got to be a primary place first. So you've got to know what it is you're writing, and you've got to be really clear about it, again, because you're going to explain this to other people. Any questions? Yes?
I have a question, Ted. Between agent and acquisition editor,
yes.
There's no way an agent can read all the material submitted to him. Do you hire people to read for you or give you critiques?
Every agent operates differently. The question was, how much do agents read of what comes in? You all collectively, however many 50 of you are in this room, are way better than most of the stuff that comes in just by the fact that you've spent the time and money to be at a place like this. And if any of you want a fascinating exercise, I'll let you read my submissions for a week, and you'll feel so much better about yourselves. The biggest pet peeve, people who don't read our website. I don't represent fiction. Let me tell you about my novel. No, I don't want to hear about your novel. I actually now have a snarky autoresponder because I just got fed up with the crap that came in. It may be a great novel. I don't care. I can't help that person. So a bunch of stuff, you can tell from the first two words. A bunch of other stuff, it was blind copied or overtly copied to 23 other agents. I'm not even going to read it. A bunch of other stuff, the first two sentences are in something resembling but not quite exactly English. I'm not going to bother reading it. So you'd be surprised, given the amount that comes in, I get, I don't know, 400 or 500 queries a month, not a huge amount. A lot of them I can pretty quickly just archive. We do carefully read the ones that come in that are a letter to me saying, though it's the submissions email, hey, here's why I think what I've got might be of interest to you. It's really helpful if somebody says, I see you've represented X, Y, and Z, and I'm writing Omega, therefore I think it might be of interest. That proves a couple of things. One, they've bothered to read my website. Two, they've thought about what I represent. Three, they've already done some of the early thinking that puts them in their own comparable title section, which we'll talk about later. Someone's giving some thought to this. The writing might be terrible. There might not be a market opportunity, but I'm going to read that whole query very carefully, and that doesn't take an enormous amount of time. So, any other questions for the moment? We'll have more. Okay, now I'm getting warm, so if we can temperature down 2 degrees. It's great. Well, because I'm putting in all this energy. You guys are relaxing. So let's talk about big changes in the book business and why the world is such a disaster and why we all should leave and just go right to the bar, even though it's not even 4 o'clock. The internet changes everything. Yes, it's trite, and yes, it's true. A buddy of mine said the internet is the universal solvent, and it's dissolving industries everywhere, and that's actually true. We are about 10 years behind the music business. iTunes has devastated the music industry, or rather the, what was then, I think, 6 major music labels. They're now down to 4, and they're 40% smaller than they were 10 years ago. Music's thriving, the industry as it was is not. And similar things are happening in book publishing. So the advent of the internet, you can see it as more and more opportunity for authors, but at the same time, it is pinching all of these different things. Obviously, Amazon is devastating Barnes & Noble, but I remember 10 years ago when everybody at the independent booksellers hated Barnes & Noble because they were destroying their business. So someone's going to come along and start to threaten Amazon. You know, things change. That's the way of the world. But the internet particularly has really started to change the way we all do business. Part of that is retailer concentration, and that actually predates the internet. That our capitalist culture is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The big box retailer, Barnes & Noble, is a new phenomenon relatively. So you've got these enormous retailers. Even the independent booksellers that are surviving are becoming bigger. And big wants to work with big. So as a way of fending off the power of a Barnes & Noble in the old days and to some extent today, and the power of the Amazon today, the publishers are combining. So if you look here, you'll see the major publishing companies. It used to be the big 6. Now we're down to the big 5.5, maybe 4.5. Just, 3 weeks ago, what was Penguin and what was Random House merged. And some of us like to call them Random Penguin. There are all kinds of fun ways to tease them about it, but they are basically, their official name is Penguin Random House globally. And depending how you want to do your math, they control something close to 40% of the trade book market in the world. That's a big honking deal. That is great when they start to negotiate against an Amazon. It's not so great when agents and authors are trying to negotiate against them. But that is the reality. So if you look at these different publishing companies, you'll see they're all owned by major corporations that are in other businesses as well. So Random Penguin is controlled by Bertelsmann, the German company. Grand Central, Little Brown, some other imprints are owned by Hachette, the French media company. Holzbrink, which is another German company, controls Macmillan, which is everything from the highest end, which is for our Strauss and Giroux, down to St. Martin's Press, which does great mass market publishing. We've got News Corp, Rupert Murdoch, whatever you think of him, that's HarperCollins and William Morrow and so on. And then you've got Viacom, which is CBS, which is split into 2 different units. And Simon & Schuster and their various imprints are part of that. So for anybody who doesn't know, imprints are small publishing companies within a large publishing company. They don't have every one of the functions. They each have a particular flavor. They'll have a single publisher and sales force that's trying to sell to Barnes & Noble, but this part here, the marketing and the acquisitions, will be targeted. So for example, at Random Penguin, there's Crown, which is a big imprint within that. Within Crown, there are smaller imprints. So Potter is the coffee table books about lifestyle and entertainment. Separately is Crown Business, which is all about business books. So you have all these different imprints and sub-imprints that are ideally really smart about their particular niche. The editors get it, their marketing people get it, they know how to pitch particular books to particular audiences. So specialization within the big umbrella, which gives them some leverage. And that's yet another reason why you have to know exactly what it is that you're pitching, because that helps us figure out, okay, here are the editors at the particular imprints that are going to be most interested and the best partners for you to potentially publish this book. So absolute clarity is really important throughout. There are lots of other kinds of publishers, though. It's really funny, even before the internet made it possible, in the traditional world, there were other options beyond the big publishers. They may have controlled between 60 to 80% of the books sold, but that's still a big chunk of a big industry that's managed by other kinds of presses. The academic presses are a big one. Everyone knows about University of California Press and Harvard and Yale and University of Chicago and so on. They do great publishing. Obviously, the core of most of those academic presses program is the PhD thesis turned into a book. But they all publish bigger, deeper books aimed sometimes at academic audiences, but also at the trade. And many of them do really, really good publishing. So across very strange areas, University of Nebraska Books has an imprint called Bison Books, all about sports, go figure. Aimed at sports enthusiasts, and they do really nice publishing. LSU, Louisiana State, is really good for some reason at publishing memoirs. Very unexpected, but they do a beautiful job. University of California Press has a lot of great, they've got an amazing cooking program, Bay Area, not surprising. They also do great popular science, and that's science books for pros to some extent, and also science books for average reader nerds like us. So they have been and continue to be a really viable option for certain types of projects. One of the funniest days I had in publishing when I moved to the agent side of the business was literally in the same day I was at a traditional publisher, one of the big corporate publishing houses, and they said, yeah, we actually want to start publishing more academic books, because that gives us the opportunity to get the course adoption market. And then once you're adopted in a course, that means every year you know you're going to get a certain number of thousands of sales. Smart, and they were trying to pursue that. The same day, that afternoon, I talked to someone at an academic press who said, yeah, we want to do more trade publishing, because if we get a bestseller, that supports our whole program. So grass is always greener. But that just means that every publisher is looking at all the good opportunities. So academic presses, I have a number of clients who publish beautifully with those imprints. I have a client right now, his book is out, all about, I was going to sing, but I clear the room. How many of you remember Alan Sherman? Hello, Mother, hello, Father? Okay, that was a big smile. Oh, he's going to be so happy. So my client, Mark Cohen, wrote the first full-length biography of Alan Sherman, who was a remarkable person. I could talk for 20 minutes, I won't do that in this setting, but anyway, it's a really neat book. Ended up selling it to an academic press, Brandeis Press. They have a line specializing, not surprisingly, in Jewish American cultural history. Alan Sherman was the first person actually to bring ethnic Jewish humor to the mainstream. John F. Kennedy was a huge fan of all people. George Plimpton. Book came out, it's been great. They did a beautiful job publishing it. And the author has been absolutely a monster, gone to every JCC in America, as well as getting himself onto WNYC, All Things Considered. So here it is, an academic press. They are over the moon because the book is doing so well, in a way that the trade presses thought, they're all regretting it now. I get calls from these editors who turned it down, admitting they blew it. We all blow it. That's, don't ever tease anybody for having the wrong judgment. But anyway, so academic presses can have great success for the right kinds of books. And then you have literally innumerable small presses. And by that, I don't mean the person who has self-published and has a lot of copies in their garage. Nothing wrong with that, I'm meaning something larger than that. And I don't mean the kinds of publishers where it's one or two titles a year. There are a lot of publishers out there that are doing between 5 and 20 titles a year. You have a Source Books, you have smaller publishers, Ben Bella, there's lots of them out there. And many of them publish beautifully, especially in targeted areas where they own their market. gardening books, that kind of thing. So wherever there's an audience of people that have information or storytelling desires, there's often a publisher that has sprung up that knows those people really well. F&W Publishing in Ohio does great craft publishing, and they're just moving into what's known as the vertical realm. All they're doing is owning enthusiast communities and trying to publish the magazines and the books for those enthusiast communities. So think carefully. If you're working on a specialty kind of title, go look on your shelf, and I'll bet you'll see a little colophon from a specialty publisher if you're doing something specific like that. You'll know better than I will who the right publishers are for that. So don't belittle small publishers. And even the small general publishers sometimes can be a better partner for an author than a Random House imprint. I have encouraged clients, as I said this morning in this room, I have encouraged clients to go with a smaller publisher sometimes, because it may make better sense for you to be the first or second book on the list at a small publisher than to be the 23rd book on the list at a major publisher. You want people fired up. You want enthusiasm from the editors, from the marketing people. You want enthusiasm from everybody in that publishing firm. That can be much more important than the size of an advance or the size of the corporation at the top. All right, I'm going to stop and get a drink of water. And any questions? Okay, you guys must be asleep. 5 more degrees colder, please. This is great. Wake them up. In the back, yes. The question is, what is creative nonfiction? Is it still viable? I love Lee Gutkind, who sort of coined the phrase many years ago. I'm not sure I still know what it means. There are a lot of folks who've defined it. At its worst, creative nonfiction is James Frey, A Million Little Pieces. At its best, it can be Executioner's Song, or, you know, there's questions, was Truman Capote actually writing the facts in his work? I tend to shy away from it only because it's often used as a label and an excuse to be a little fast and loose with the facts. And what I care about more is who's telling a good story. And why does somebody need to be hugely creative? If your storytelling style is unique, that's fine. But if you're telling a true story, then tell the true story in a really lovely writing way. Whereas if you really want to write something that's truly creative, it can be based in reality, but make it a novel. Why constrain yourself if it's not necessary? So I'm not really answering your question because I don't see it very often. I hear the phrase less often, I think because of some of the abuses. And I think better is to say, hey, am I writing fact or am I writing fiction? Do I need to write fact? Is the actual factual nature of what's going on absolutely essential? And that's the question that comes up with memoir of any sort, no matter how creative you might be writing it. Yeah, the academic presses, now their core is always going to be straightforward nonfiction in the realms that their universities are strong on. But if you do your research, every academic press has a website, as does every publisher, and you can get a sense for an occasional specialty area that they might be strong in.
There was a guy who took pictures in San Francisco, and he lined them up with the Bible stories that buildings still in existence from the earthquake of 1906.
Yeah, refotographing has actually become a thing in the art world, and there are some smart publishers that do all these kinds of publishing. So we're tight on time. Let me hold that thought and answer some other questions in the back.
Yes, I'm under a little bit of pressure to write a proposal for someone I just pitched to who thinks she might put me in her 2014 fall lineup, and so I'm going to hurry and get it into her tomorrow. And so I have a question about, a table of contents. If I'm doing a memoir that also includes legal documents and glossaries and things like that, is there a special way to do something unique? I haven't done a table of contents yet.
You're asking a specialty question that's actually better suited for a little later in this session and sounds very specific to your project.
I'm sorry.
So no, that's okay. So let's hold that for now. We're going to cover the table of contents and lots of aspects of it a little bit later. And then if we haven't addressed it in that moment, I'll be happy to talk with you afterwards.
And I'm leaving to pitch, so I might just come back.
That is fine. Yes.
Just real quick, when we're writing you our pitch letter, and we've kept in mind the different publishers or imprints that this might be useful for, are we mentioning that in our letter?
That's actually a great question. Everything I've told you here is background and context. arguably, I've wasted all of your time by going through all of this, because this is the stuff you shouldn't worry about. Except to know exactly what you're writing and who your reader is. All of this stuff in between is the stuff that agents are supposed to be doing for you. So to have a sense, hey, these are the imprints, okay. More important is, hey, here are the audiences, and look, there are a bunch of publishers that reach that audience. That's a validation point for you, clarity for you, and then let us do our jobs. It is a negative if you say, oh, I think this is suitable for FSG and St. Martin's and Dave's printing shop in the corner, whatever. You won't know as well as we do, and do you want me to do my job or not? So to have a sense that, yes, there are plausible places for your book, absolutely. To go into the detail, not necessary and actually contraindicated, as the doctors say. Yeah?
First thing you probably look for is writing quality. What's the second thing?
Writing quality. We'll talk about that as we go through the proposal. So, so all of these changes I've talked about, this value chain is changing. And the relationships are changing. Everything is up for grabs. The one thing that is actually becoming more intense than it used to be, and this is going to sound totally self-serving and tough, it is the agent-author relationship. That it is that much harder. Either you're going to go direct publishing, or you need an agent more than ever because the leverage is less and less for individual authors. So it's becoming a bifurcated world for opportunities for authors. Years ago, Salman Rushdie said that in what was then 25 years of his writing career, he had had more editors than he could even remember, but he'd had one agent that whole time. Editors are losing their jobs constantly. Imprints are going away constantly. Companies are being bought and sold constantly. You're hopefully going to end up in a good working relationship if an agency relationship is right for you, that's long-term, that's about career, that it's about a variety of other elements, not just this particular project. So I make the most money over time once I'm working with somebody where we get along, we're helping each other, and all that early spin-up where you sort of get comfy and figure out what someone's all about. Why would I want to start that over again? Why would the author want to start that over again? Hopefully we've got a long-term relationship that's based on mutual success. But let's talk about self-publishing. This is not a self-publishing workshop. I can't talk to you in great detail about it, one, because of time, two, because I don't know that much. I've done some direct publishing for clients. Some of you may know Keith Devlin. He's the math guy on Saturday morning NPR, a charming British guy, Stanford professor. Hello, Keith Devlin, yeah? He's got the great accent. He's awesome. He's also an amazingly facile writer. He's written 29 books, I think, in his career. Interestingly, he had a book came out a couple years ago all about Fibonacci. Most of you may have heard of the Fibonacci series. He was actually a historical human being who was literally the person who brought Arabic numerals from the Arab world to the West back in the 1500s. That literally, there was no such thing as accounting. A shopkeeper didn't have numbers. And he changed the world. See, changed the world. You always want to look for that. So anyway, Keith, there had been no biography written about him. So Keith wrote this wonderful book about Fibonacci. There was a chapter he was going to include that was all about parallels between Fibonacci and Steve Jobs. Because 800 years apart, they actually brought personal computing revolutions to bear. Steve Jobs with the personal computer, Fibonacci with literally numbers that we could use. But the chapter didn't really work in the book. It was contemporary and the rest of the book was history and it just didn't fit. In the old days, we would have pitched it to Wired or Scientific American as an article for publicity for the book itself. But I said to Keith, hey, what about publishing it as an electronic short? He said, yeah, how do we do that? So he and I said, let's do it. I did it for him under our agency agreement, and we published a little book called Leo and Steve, Leonardo and Steve Jobs. And it was this wonderful little compliment to the book. We talked to the publisher, which is Bloomsbury, that was publishing the physical book, and it was too short a time horizon. They don't sell shorts. It just didn't make any sense. They were delighted for that Keith was doing this other thing. They gave us permission to include the first chapter of the full book in the ebook, so it became a marketing tool. And the really interesting and utterly unexpected element that made it really work was that the publicist said, oh yeah, there were people that turned down the opportunity to talk to Keith because, oh, it's this work of old history and numbers. But as soon as I called back and said, oh, you know, Steve Jobs and this 800-year-old guy had a lot in common, oh, Steve Jobs. So pretty soon the publicist was able to book Keith into places that had turned him down before. So everybody benefited. So to that extent, we did some direct publishing. It sold nicely on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Smashwords. But in terms of the big picture, that was a great compliment. The really deep knowledge about how to self-publish, if you're doing that as your career basis, I just plead ignorance. I wish I could tell you more. I do know, though, that there are an enormous number of success stories already. The speaker in that room yesterday, the guy who writes science fiction, talked about how to do well on Amazon. He's, what, he sold 25,000 copies of his three books in a year?
Two books.
There you go. There are also a lot of non-success stories, but the opportunities are there. If it's something you want to think about, definitely pursue it. It is a legitimate opportunity because of the digital world in a way that in the old days you had to spend 20 grand to get a garage full of books. Now you don't have to go to that expense. So I'll leave that at that. It is a legitimate option. Sometimes it leads to traditional deals. Sometimes it just leads to big fat checks and swimming pools for you without involvement from anybody here. So it's a legitimate option in this day and age. In all of this, though, it all comes down to you getting big. You'll see, I noted in the last bullet point in this first big section, genres are changing at different paces. How many people here have an e-reader and read books electronically? About half. Okay, that's interesting. Industry-wide, about 20% of all books, trade books, are sold digitally. Within genres, though, romance, mystery, science fiction, it's 50%. So it's a strange distribution. Not everything's happening at the same pace in every part of the business. So discontinuities are here. In all of this, though, what you want is that everything you do to be feeding on everything else you do and to be building your brand. How many people here have wanted to be an action figure? Yeah, it's here, okay. You know, the McDonald's Happy Meal should feature you as the writer as well. But that's the goal. And in publishing, as in any of the media, everything feeds on itself. So if you've got the Lord of the Rings movie that's feeding off the old books, that's also selling more of the old books, that's selling the action figures, that's selling the board game, that's selling the video game, everybody in the business, if you're going through anything at all like this traditional chain, is looking for all those kinds of opportunities, all those kinds of places where everything you're doing is building on everything else you're doing. Again, big wants to deal with big. Awful words, but they're words we're going to keep coming back to, platform and synergy. Platform and synergy. Synergy means are all the things you're doing feeding on each other, and platform just means almost literally how high do you stand above the crowd. And when we get to the proposal, we'll talk more in detail about what those are. Any questions? Yeah.
So I'm brilliant in a number of areas, you know.
Of course.
And one of the things that I get a little stuck with is if an agent really likes, say, a nonfiction, but then they don't do fiction, do you just go, yeah, whatever, I'm not talking to you anymore? I mean, like, how do you...
The question is for authors that are writing in multiple areas. Fiction and non, one of the things is you should be focused on a single book. You may pitch a couple books in a setting like this, but agents and publishers want to know that it's called a next book clause, literally. That this book that they're signing up is the next book you're going to work on, and you're going to be focused on that book. Because if I'm a publisher, I do not want to buy the book and know at the same time that you're busy over here and over here and over here. Last I checked, that's the moral equivalent of polyamory, and that's fine, but that's not usually many people are comfortable with that. So pitch one, because you want your full effort to be driven behind getting this book to be a success. And then long-term for an agent relationship,
yeah.
You may find, I have a client who does fiction and non. I do not represent his fiction. He has another agent who does his science fiction. That's something you need to have a human conversation about. There aren't rules to this. You just need to be very forthright about your situation, what you're looking for, and listen carefully when people come back to you. Yeah?
In your experience, are there any credibility issues with setting yourself up as an expert in e-publishing? Is it more credible to the traditional publishing?
Let me ask the larger, or point to the larger question, which is how legitimate is electronic publishing?
Could you repeat the question?
Sure. The question was, for a subject matter expert, does the fact that you've electronically published mean less than it would be if you had a traditional book out? I would divide it into self-publishing versus third-party publishing of any sort, digital or otherwise. There's always going to be a suspicion. If someone comes recommended to us, we are more open and think more highly of them than if we just stumble across them. It's the, oh, you should meet my friend versus, oh, I met this stranger in a bar. That's just human nature. So you're always going to have a little bit more inherent credibility if you've been spoken for by a third party, the imprimatur of a big publisher. And sometimes folks want the biggest possible publisher saying, oh, that's the biggest imprimatur. Sometimes that matters. Other times, the quality of what you're getting out there, the quality of your insights, and your ability to assemble an audience is utterly untouched by who's published your work. So for authors that are building their own platform, that are getting themselves out in the world, the book may sit here, and the fact that it exists, it's just a brochure for your work, and it's a way to monetize, you know, get $15 from people. They couldn't care less what it says down here, because they're already in the room with you. So there's not a single answer. There are no question going to be a little bit more in the way of doubts if a project's self-published, but you can overcome that by the fact that you're marketing it, and you should know who your audience is and be able to persuade them your hot stuff, or lukewarm stuff, or whatever you are. Any questions? Okay, good. Let's talk about from idea to book tour, and then take a 3-minute break just to stand up and do jumping jacks. It all distills down to these three key principles. They're trite and they're in cute quotes, but they are really legit. And I've been saying this since before the days of digital publishing, but all publishing is self-publishing. I always bully self-publishing folks into doing a book proposal anyway. You may not be pitching it to anybody else, but it's just a business plan. And why on earth would you put yourself, let alone your loved ones, through the time, the neuroses, the expense, the lost sleep, if you don't have a plan in place to do it? This is ridiculous. I spend more of my time trying to talk people out of writing a book than into writing a book, partly because if I could persuade you not to do it, you wouldn't have succeeded anyway. The roller coaster is guaranteed for anybody, and I'll tell some stories in a little bit. The ultimate roller coaster stories, actually, that started here at this conference. But you have to understand that's the way it's going to be. Treat this as self-publishing. Treat this as a project you're doing for yourself. And understand that even if you're working through all the traditional channels, it's still your book first and foremost. No matter how fired up a publisher is for your book, they're also publishing 30 or 40 other books at the same time. So be very self-possessed, very self-aware. And then point two, get famous first. Everybody comes to me and says, great, get me a book deal, and then, you know, then I'll be famous. And no, it's the other way around. So who here has been on Oprah? Yeah, she's been off the air a while, but it's funny, at every conference for a while there, I'd say, who's been on Oprah? And one person would put their hand up. I have a client who is this close. She's going to be on Ellen this fall. We're still waiting for the confirmation, which, of course, is BS, because until the day it airs, you're never sure it's really going to happen. But she actually has a project that went viral. And it's amazing. You may have seen it. It's called Dance in a Year. She's a tiny little gal who decided she wanted to be a better dancer, you know, pop locking, sort of break dancing, and started to film herself, set up her iPhone, that's it, thank you. She filmed herself, and it's really embarrassing the first few moments. And she's a terrible dancer, was. And then slowly filmed herself over the course of a year. She practiced more and more. And by the end, she had a friend set up the camera in the San Francisco's BART system. And she jumps off the train and starts to dance, breakdancing on the platform as the train starts zipping by. It's the most dramatic thing you've ever seen, and she's actually become a really good dancer. So what she did was she made herself famous because she put this video up on the web. And then you think, oh, great, the world found it. BS. She marketed the hell out of that video. And so I want you guys to go to danceinayear.com. And she's been blogging for Fast Company as well. Her name is Karen X Cheng, C-H-E-N-G. And she just had a blog post up 2 days ago. It's all about how do you market yourself to make yourself go viral. Nothing happens by accident.
Danceinayear.com.
Or just Google Karen X Cheng, and you're all Google whizzes. You'll find it pretty quickly. So she made herself famous first. I'll give you another example. How many of you have seen a book called Steal Like an Artist? It's a little black book by Austin Kleon. Selfishly, and also in a very pro bono way, you all need to go buy it. It's brilliant, and it's all about remix culture, and where does an artist get their impulses and their influences, and it's all about the notion that no art is truly original. Anyway, Austin was an advertising copywriter down in, coincidentally, Austin, Texas. Got invited to a small upstate New York college to give a little talk about creativity, and he gave this presentation. Quoting everybody from Albert Einstein to Picasso, who said, none of my ideas were my own, I stole everything I ever did. And then it was a guide to what do you do with these insights. It was fine, and then he put the proposal up on his personal website, which didn't have much traffic, he was a nobody. But slowly, he got the word out, he would give some talks here and there. He was just an advertising copywriter, but he nudged it. And pretty soon people started to discover it, and it got discovered and discovered and discovered and discovered. And by the time he and I started talking about it, he had 1.6 million visits to that one web page on his personal website. That was a very easy deal to do. I'm a good agent, didn't matter. It was a really easy deal to do. We ended up having four publishers fighting over it. The auction went on for 2 weeks.
Name again?
Steal Like an Artist. His name is Austin Kleon, K-L-E-O-N. His next book is called Show Your Work, and it's all about the artistic process. And he's the living proof point of what he's advocating, which is that you get your stuff out there, and you start iterating now, getting feedback. So in some ways, if Steal Like an Artist is all about how to steal other people's influences and ideas, Show Your Work is all about how to get other people to steal from you. So he's been on Twitter, on his own Tumblr, all over the place, just sort of sharing these ideas and getting them out there, and slowly coalesced into a book. But in the meantime, Steal Like an Artist got a ton of attention on the web, book was published, ended up on the New York Times bestseller list for 28 weeks last year. He's now got 225,000 copies in print in a year and a half. He's a bright guy, it's a great project, but he was nudging himself out there. He got famous, then we got the book deal, and then with that sense of synergy, everything he does online feeds the book, the book's presence in, actually, the Portland Art Museum. It's in the section that's black. The cover is black. They have this really cute merchandise section. Black jewelry, black purses, and a black book. But it's there. And every time someone sees that book and they'll look, oh, AustinKleon.com, they go check him out on the web. Everything feeds on itself. Yeah?
So what was the distance of time between the lecture in upstate New York and when you started working with him? How long was he?
That's an interesting question. How long did it go from when he gave the talk to it having taken off online? I don't know for sure. It was something on the order of maybe a year. Karen Chang, it was within weeks. So there is no sense of, if you get big, it's like you could be an overnight success after 10 years. You're still a great success and you can do great things. Those intervening 10 years, nobody needs to know about. It doesn't matter. So,
Can you just ask, in a proposal, or you want to be putting all this in there? I mean, this is important information. You have a platform and exactly what that platform is.
This is all essential. This is how you're telling me your hot stuff and how I then tell editors your hot stuff. All of this stuff, if you can't brag about yourself, nobody else can do it for you. So light under a bushel, pick your biblical reference, whatever. Get your own little vuvuzela and start trumpeting. That's key. Yeah.
So if your strongest platform is in another culture, another language, those kinds of things. What I'm finding is that even though you can put that on as a platform, there are a lot of people who suddenly group you into the Latin American, the Latino, the this, even though you're, for instance, I just finished a collaboration with Che Guevara's nephew, and people hear, okay, Che Guevara, Cuba, but this is about, what is it like, the book is called Shadow of Him. What is it like to grow up with this uncle, and how do you overcome that? And that is totally universal.
Well, let's talk about audiences, because you're raising an interesting point. Her point is that she may have some fame in a certain community, but the book could appeal to broader audiences. And we're going to talk about that in more detail in a little bit, because you want multiple audiences. Think in terms of onion. You have to make the argument, here's my core audience, but then here are additional ancillary audiences that may overlap, they may not, but first you got to have a core audience that's going to sell the first 5 or 10 or 100,000 books, and then you can go beyond that. So we'll come back and talk about that in more detail. Any other questions? Okay, great. So that's point two, is get famous first. And then the last one is, and again, the fact that you're here really is a point in everybody's favor, you're acting like business people, which is great. And I'm a business tool. I'm one of the few people in publishing, apparently, with an MBA, which I'm embarrassed by. One, because it wasn't a particularly useful degree, but more, we're an industry. This is business. And you need to see yourselves. You don't have to go get an MBA. Hopefully today serves as your MBA. But the notion of treating yourself like the CEO of your own multimedia empire. And there's several things packed into that. One, you're the CEO. You're in charge. I work for you, not the other way around. And anybody who forgets that, whether it's on your side or mine, is ending up doing a disservice to the whole process. Two is, you really are trying to build a multimedia empire. The core may be a book. Your core may be workshops you teach. Your core may be something else entirely. You're just a great famous blogger or on YouTube making money off of ads that sell on YouTube. It doesn't matter, but you want other elements that are hopefully reinforcing this. So you're CEO of a multimedia and then empire. I love that word. make no small plans. If you don't want to be big and famous and make a boatload of money, why should I work with you? Where was it? I think it was Seattle, the Pacific Northwest Conference a couple of years ago. They had all the agents introduce themselves. And they went down the row, and agent after agent, this is so bitchy, I'm sorry, but agent after agent said, oh, I do this for love, I do this because I'm passionate, and this is, I love business, and I work for, and it got to me, and I was in a pissy mood, and I hadn't had coffee yet, and I just said, I do this for the money. And the room burst into applause. This, right, why are you doing this? Yes, you want, money is a proxy, but it's a wonderful proxy for how many people are hearing what you have to say. A friend of mine is good friends with Jonathan Franzen, the novelist. Just was drinking with him, doing an interview with him for a magazine she's starting. And he is doing a really weird new book coming out. It's quite interesting, and I have no idea how well it's going to sell. He's annotating a German classic, which he translated himself. God bless him, we'll see. But he said that he really loves the fact that he's made a lot of money, because that just means how many people have bought his book. That's all it means. You're making $3 a book on a hardback and $1 a book on a paperback. Why wouldn't you want to make more money rather than less? So for you, there's the pleasure of creation. For me, there's the fear of creation. I'm a recovering writer. I hate it. So the only pleasure I get out of this is by making money. So help me help you. Remember that agent movie? Jerry Maguire? Help me help you. So you are CEO. We work for you. I'm your director of sales. Your critique and edit group, they're your sort of director of product development. This is separate even from self-publishing. At that point, you really are building your own publishing company. But you need to have a sense of self, a sense of aggression. Yes, even you women, don't give me that look. I got a look over here. In this day and age, in any day and age, you need to be absolutely relentless and calluses on the forehead, because otherwise you're not going to succeed. It's a nightmarish industry, which has become that much more pinched because of Amazon. Self-publishing, do you have any idea how many self-publishing titles came out last year? 500,000 or more? There are more and more copies coming out through traditional publishers. This chain is getting pinched and more cramped. The publishers are agglomerating, meaning they have more leverage to squeeze authors on lower advances and crappy ebook royalties. How many people here are depressed? Yes, all right, good. I'm trying to scare you guys away. And again, as I said before, it's because if I can scare you away now, I've saved you a lot of grief, and your families will thank me, because you're going to be a lot less cranky for the next 6 years. All right. It's now time to talk about some of the nuts and bolts, but the big piece here, the second bullet point, is about recruiting a good management team. And I want to end with that and just take a sip and have everyone literally stand up. Again, your CEO, get people around you. Even though it's your solitary project, great things are created by teams. How many people here don't like to give advice? Yeah, I figured that'd be the case. It's amazing the advice you can get from really smart people just from asking. And yes, your friends and loved ones, that's fine. Number of years ago, I came to this weird insight. Number of years ago, I made a bunch of really stupid life decisions, and I gave up. And I just stopped making my own decisions, and I would consult the committee. We all have a committee. Even you, any social ones in the back, we all have a committee. And it got to the point where I had 2 job offers in the 1 or 2 dot-com booms ago. And I didn't know which to take, so I literally sent out an email, offer A, offer B. And offers were a dime a dozen. I mean, that's not a big deal yet, offers. But I didn't know what, and the vote came back. And I did what the group said, and it turned out to be the right thing. So you need to be relying on groups of others for their expertise, for their insight, for their encouragement, for their discouragement. So assemble the people around you, especially folks that know what they're doing. And that's why I put a list here. You know, you've got to get your writing group, and I'm going to keep barking at you if you don't spend this weekend, those of you who don't have one, meeting the person next to you. You know, we'll treat this like a church. Meet somebody, say Shabbat Shalom, and, you know, find a new writing partner. Copy editors, consulting editors, book doctors, lawyer, maybe when the time comes, literary agent, local booksellers. You know, you guys are fortunate, those of you that are truly local with Powell's, but there are other great local bookstores here. Every city's got them. Booksellers are, by definition, the closest to the readers. Rely on them. You know, make friends. Go check out, hey, what's selling these days? Hey, I'm working on this project. You think this makes any sense? You know, during the Christmas crush, when the cash register is swamped, you know, you don't want to pester someone then, but go to the info desk and make friends. One, you're going to learn a lot. Two, you're going to get a little bit of encouragement. And three, when the time comes, hey, maybe you're going to get a reading because you started to build a local presence. So assemble this team of people around you that are trusted advisors. It's amazing how little it takes to bribe people to be an advisor to you. Really, just a pat on the head and a pat on the back does it. A big vat of red sauce once in a while is even better for a dinner party you can throw for them, but there are plenty of ways to get good expert advice. So, any questions?
Isn't there a temptation when you get your own personal board of directors to get people to tell you what you want to hear?
That's a great question. Are you just going to hear what, are they going to tell you what you want to know? And that's up to you to choose the right members of the board of directors and hold them to it and say, if all I get is yeses, I'm not cooking for you people anymore. Yeah, and in writing groups, that's the very good point she raises, that in writing groups, everybody's invested in giving good, smart advice, not just sort of rah-rah. And if you're in a group that's all rah-rah, find a different group. So, all right, everybody, please stand up.
Yes.
All right, everybody, close your eyes. Okay, everybody, put your arms straight up. Take a deep breath. Okay, great, thank you. What a nice looking bunch of people. All right, everybody sit down. We're ready to continue.
Can we decrease the temp just a couple degrees?
Cooler?
Yeah, I mean...
Warmer?
Warmer, yeah.
Okay, we need 2 degrees back up again. It's like Scotty back there in the engine room. This is great. How are the dilithium crystals holding up?
Can't read it all the way.
Oh, so clap yourself. Okay. And now the moment you're all waiting for. No, there's no lottery, there's no prizes, there's not, just it's time to talk about the nuts and bolts of a proposal. So, on the back, although I didn't number them, so I'll let you figure out which back is, but there is this overview of a book proposal. If you go to my website and download the same document, it's in a Word doc, I think. I don't know, anyway, you can cut and paste. It's really straightforward. We're just going to go through this section by section. If you can read, you can leave, because this all right here. All I'm going to do is talk at greater length, but it's basically all right here. And for any of you that have done any work in the .com world or in any of the business worlds, this is essentially the PowerPoint document that's a pitch to venture capitalists. Because book publishers are venture capitalists, you just want them to give you money to finish developing your product, which is a book. Understand this is just business. You know, think Sopranos, this is just business, Tony. And everything that goes into this is obviously going to be a deep expression of your persona and your ego and your talents, but it's got to be a business plan for strangers who you want, whom you want to give you money. In back.
I don't get why. It's been like this for a long time that authors are required to do a lot of marketing. And then there's the agents and all that who make a lot of business. And I really don't understand why there aren't any like marketing agencies.
So the question is, why aren't there marketing agencies for authors? And the answer is, to some extent, there are. In book publishing, it's really closer, more often known as publicity, which is about getting media coverage for your book. But can I draw this? I'm not sure. It's sort of like drawing the solar system. This is not to scale. But the number of folks writing books is about this wide. The number of folks that are writing quality books is about this wide. The number of folks that have commercial potential for their books is like this. And the number of folks that are going to make it all the way through an agency into a publisher is about like that. So it's totally suggestive and it's totally bitchy, but that's frankly the way it really is. There are probably 6 million novels in desk drawers or hard drives all over America. So the question is, how many of those authors would want to spend money for the marketing help in a way that would be worthwhile? You can spend a lot of money on professionals. And I would not advocate for most authors that they should do that. In part because if you're going to become a famous person, you got to do that on your own early on. That no matter how talented a publicity firm or a PR firm or a marketing firm you hire, if you don't have what it takes to start, there's nothing they can do to make you famous. And most of the ways you make yourself famous in the world in the short term are actually by producing the work, writing op-eds, giving talks, somehow getting out there in a world that's about you. It's not about a publicist saying, hey, she's hot stuff. It's by being hot stuff. So there's only so much that strangers can do for you on those aspects. All right. So let's talk, first of all, any other questions? All right. Let's talk about the business plan, the book proposal. There's two sides to it, and that is the substance and the style. So let's talk about substance first, because that makes us feel nicest. I'm trying to get you a little away from the depression. A again, for nonfiction, you do not need to finish the manuscript, with the exception of memoirs, because memoirs are much more like a first novel, that no one really believes you can write a full book that hangs together as a full book that tells a compelling story until you've actually done it. Some people say, well, you know, I've written these first 60 pages and they're brilliant. They may in fact be, but it's a little bit like saying, hey, I jog 3 miles a day. That does not mean you're ready for a marathon. And let's say you get the book deal for a memoir. You still got to sit down and finish it. So just sit down and finish it. But for the range of general nonfiction like we've laid out here, that's sold on proposal, and that is a sample chapter and a detailed table of contents. And those two elements are proving a couple of important things. One, that you can write, hey, here's a full sample chapter that's beautiful, it hangs together, it's reflective of the way that I'm going to write this book. And the detailed table of contents is the roadmap that says, hey, here's my chapter one, and here's everything else I'm going to do, I just need the time and the money and the space to finish it up. That could be a narrative table of contents that lays out, you know, here's the rest of the story. If you're doing something that's journalistic and or otherwise requires some research, it's okay to say, I'll be flying to Afghanistan to do some additional reporting for these chapters. You don't have to have everything finished up, but you do have to have a really clear sense of what finishing up entails. And also, everybody knows that's going to change. That's okay, but it's got to be a good provisional detailed table of contents, which could be anywhere from 3 to 10 pages, sometimes longer. I have a client who did a great book called The Probiotics Revolution. And he worked with a co-author because he's an MD, PhD researcher at University of Michigan. Knows he's not a writer, had no qualms, no pretense otherwise. Worked with a co-author who had done this for a living, Sarah Wernick. She's dead now, but she's wonderful, just a brilliant writer, had multiple bestsellers, was a professional collaborator. And she wrote the detailed table of contents for his book in narrative form, in his voice, that went on for about 20 pages, that just talked about, here's what I want to talk about next, and here, in a very personal way. And so by the end, you had a sense for, hey, this is how it's going to read, and here's the whole map of the book. In the more traditional model, you're going to lay out chapter by chapter. In this chapter, we're going to cover X, Y, and Z. It will include A, B, and C. And these are the proof points I'm going to include. And then you go on to the next chapter, and you lay it out in detail. The other piece of that is then with that sample chapter, where you show this is exactly the writing style. Some people say, well, I haven't done a lot of research yet. All I have is what's, you know, chapter 7. That's okay, but that also presumes that someone's read chapters 1 through 6 in the final book. So it may not be great for a reader. You'll have to explain a little bit. Oh, up till now you will have learned a variety of things. Now here's chapter 7. Better is to start with your first real chapter. Not the intro, but the chapter that's written in the style in which the whole book is going to be written, that shows a stranger, oh yeah, she or he, they can write. I get it. This is compelling. I'm drawn from page 1 through page 27. Great. Where's the rest of the book? You want to get someone so fired up, but by the time they finish that sample chapter, they can't wait to read the rest. So that's the substance. Sample chapter, detailed table of contents. That's the real book itself. The rest is all the arm waving, the fun stuff that's the business side. So let's start with, well, you know, let's be solipsistic. Author credentials. Who the heck are you? This is where you get to brag. This is where you get to tout how wonderful you are, and you're the best thing since sliced and buttered bread. So I want to know everything that makes you the best person to write this book, the only person to write this book, and the only person to promote and publicize this book. So you were talking about your particular audience. Talk about your core audience. Hey, you're on Univision regularly. Great. Whatever it is. Whatever your field is, that you're a noted chef. It may or may not be, this is the platform element, it may or may not be the kinds of things where it's public. You may or may not be, let's say you're not a regular commentator in the New York Times, okay? You could be a hidden rock star in the sense that maybe you give workshops all over America. It's in a field that if somebody's not in that field, they wouldn't know about, but you teach on A, B, and C, you teach to 8,000 people a year. That's a big deal. Tell me who you are, tell me how many people you reach, how much you are hot stuff. Do you have a question?
Is that in first person? What person is that?
Oh, that's a great question. Do you write it in first person, or if it's more emotionally comfortable, you can write about it in third person? Although that could also be weird. I'm talking about myself. That's even weirder. It doesn't matter. It's up to you. You know, you're bragging. Figure out the best way to brag. Yes?
So question. If you have somewhat of a platform in a different realm, for example, you talk to 8,000 people a year across the United States, the world, or what have you, but your book is on something outside of your profession where you have this platform. Does that carry any weight or no? Does the platform have to be...
If you are known as a Tour de France writer and have people have seen you on television regularly, and you're writing a book about psychotherapy, it's going to be a bit of a stretch. You might want to mention, hey, I'm comfortable in front of crowds. I'm a good public speaker. You know, that's the kind of credentialing that is transportable to any realm. But the question that you want to answer here is, hey, how many copies can you sell because of how hot you are, how perfect you are in the audience that's likely to buy your book? And that's where we then transition to the next section, which is who's your target audience? And these can be sort of in any order, because you basically want to talk about them all at once, but you have to sequence them, because otherwise it's a cacophony of voices. So, all right, who are you aiming this book at? And that's always going to be, almost always going to be multiple audiences. Who's your core audience? Who are the ancillary audiences that are also going to be of interested in this?
Could you include testimonials from people from your platform within this?
Question is, do you include testimonials? Let's come back to that in the marketing section under blurbs. Okay. I'll come back to that. Just remind me if I haven't covered that.
Okay.
So what you want is, in that target audience, who are the core readers? Who's going to spend $28 or $15 and a couple of weeks' time to enjoy your book? And that's a big change from anybody who might be publishing in periodicals or anywhere else, or blogging, or on Twitter, or whatever else. Don't underestimate the vast difference between free and a penny, let alone free and $18 or free and $28. It's a BFD. It's really hard to get people to open their wallets. So you've got to explain, these are the folks that are going to be really interested in what I have to say, so interested, in fact, that they're going to reach into their pockets and pull out money. And let's talk about the multiple audiences. They can be overlapping audiences, sort of a Venn diagram. They can be a core audience and external audiences. Whatever it is, help me understand who's everybody who's going to be interested in this book and why they're going to buy the book. Sometimes you can quantify audiences. I have an author who did a book called Eczema Free for Life. He's a noted dermatologist, and came to me at actually a writer's conference and said, you know, there's actually new news and new science in the world of eczema and dermatology. DNA studies and everything else. Oh, that's interesting. And he said, and in fact, and this got me immediately, there are 20 million Americans who have eczema. And there are 10 million kids who have eczema. 20 million adults, 10 million kids. That's about as crisp a definition of a target market as you're ever going to get. You're rarely going to get it that well. And not all 20 million are going to buy it, but immediately I know, great, this is it, this is the crowd. I have a sense for the size of the market. Then you want the third element of these three things that play into each other are the comparable titles. And I say comparable titles, not competitive titles, because you're trying to do two different, slightly contradictory things. You're trying to show that there is no other book like yours in the world. Worst thing we get is, oh, you know, there's no book like mine. Well, maybe there's a reason for that, but you're trying to show there's no other book exactly like yours, and yet books that are somewhat like yours on some important dimensions have sold well. So you guys remember Venn diagrams. So you want books that are somewhat in this category, somewhat in that category, somewhat in that category. Only mine is at that unique intersection. And then the marketing promotion section, we can only talk a little bit about today, but that is everything you're going to do if you were self-publishing to get that book out there. And one of the elements is blurbs. And this gets back to the point we said earlier about third-party endorsement. And to the extent that you can get not a testimonial from Dave on the street raving about your book, that's irrelevant, but to the extent that you can get names that are going to go on the back cover of your book, that in the bookstore, you know, people pick it up, and then first thing we do is we do this, and then we do that. And if I see a name that I trust, or that I admire, or that at least is famous, I'm that much more likely to think, oh, this book's pretty good.
But would those blurb, like, for the proposal, because the book hasn't been published yet, I'm just, this is a proposal, would the blurbs be helpful?
Absolutely. If you can get blurbs now, the blurbs, you want to get blurbs as early as possible. And if it's someone saying, she's great and knowledgeable, wonderful. If it's, this book is brilliant, wonderful. If it's both, even better. Either of those, though, helps put you above the crowd. It's somebody, I'd say, ooh, they're hot stuff. They're saying good things about her. By transitive property, she's probably hot stuff.
Okay.
So, how many of you know Gary Steingart, the novelist? He's a Russian emigre, really funny novelist, right? It became a running joke where people were teasing him on Twitter. He would blurb anything. I mean, almost literally anything. He was blurbing fast food outlets. It didn't matter. It became a great joke. But he was so good at writing blurbs, and he was so famous that for a while there it actually worked. Now, if you see a blurb from him, it becomes a point of humor in its own right. But if there are subject matter experts or famous people or both that say you're hot stuff, I'm that much more likely to say, oh, she is. Let me tell you guys about a 6-minute fable that will have a lot of things packed into it that also share the arc of wonderful, wonderful, terrible, 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 and hopefully coming back up at the end. So that'll be our meta experience for the day. You guys still depressed? No, this is good. At this very conference, at this very hotel, I was sitting at a table in the big room, and a guy came up to me first thing in the morning with hair out, eyes pinwheeling. Turned out he hadn't slept the night before because he really wanted to print out his manuscript. His toner died. His printer wasn't working. He had to find a Kinko's. Long story short, he was a mess. Sits down across from me, papers flying. We get him onto a stretcher and we calm him down, and he told me about this project. And it was, I don't know, some of you may have heard the story or know about the book. He was a local columnist at the Eugene Register Guard, a guy named Bob Welch. And had, though he's a evangelical Christian and writes mostly about family themes and Christianity and so on, he had discovered this story about a Jewish nurse in World War II who was actually an Eastern European emigre, came to the States during World War I, fleeing difficult times, and then, because this country meant so much to her, decided to volunteer for the U.S. Army. He had heard about her story and found it really moving, because she'd been killed actually in action. But thought this was really inspiring. He had written a column about it. It really touched a nerve. A lot of people, more than just normally read his column, it got picked up elsewhere. He flew himself to the National Archives. He flew himself to Normandy over several years period because he got obsessed by the story and really wanted to, thought this warranted a full-length book. So I said, oh, interesting. I can see some audiences here, nurses, anybody looking for an inspirational woman's story, anybody looking for a story about World War II. You're interesting because you're a local columnist. You may not be known in Kansas City or New York, but you've got a local following. You're obviously a good writer. This is an interesting story. I'm starting to see the pieces as they come together. I'll look at the proposal. A couple days later, I call him. I say, well, I think your proposal is twice as long as it needs to be, but if you're comfortable cutting it down in ways I'm suggesting, I'd like to work with you. And he says, great. We work on the proposal, hone it. End up going out, sell it to an imprint at Simon & Schuster called Atria Books. He is over the moon. Everybody's happy. This is great. Only then does he tell me that before I agreed to take him on, 26 other agents had turned it down, which is proof that theirs is all human judgment. I've turned down stuff that's gone on to bestsellerdom. I've picked up a project that nobody else saw potential in, honed it, and it turned into a great success. So I'm trying to throw a bunch of different elements at you to show you that no one path is the same, but these are key principles. One is, it's all personal judgment. So anyway, the book is in process. As you know, we only sold it on a sample chapter. He had to write the rest of the book. And his editor, who at the time was at Atria, Brenda Copeland, great editor. She had some of the best advice, really helped him improve it well beyond what I could do. She had one of the best lines of advice I've ever heard, which I repeat now to every newspaper journalist. She said to him at one point, you know, Bob, paragraphs can have more than one sentence. So he went back once again and rewrote the book, and it was just beautiful. So this sounds great. A major publisher is publishing this book he's worked on for years, a very personal project, he's fired up, and then he gets a call. Brenda picks up the phone and says, Bob, I wanted to let you know that in the time between when we bought the book and when we're going to publish it, we've also acquired Pamela Anderson's novel, which it turns out she literally had never even read, let alone written. Of course it was ghostwritten. She never read it. She was interviewed on the air and she had to sort of, oops. But because they'd spent $1 million on the advance for that, they were going to then devote all their resources to it. And I give the editor credit. He told Bob. He's distraught. This is horrible. 3 days of depression. I'm depressed. He's depressed. We're weeping on the phone. But then he says, God darn it, I'm going to make that. He didn't say that because he's an evangelical Christian, but he said, gosh darn it, I'm going to make this happen. And he picked himself up, dusted himself off, and got calluses on his forehead, continued to press. Something I didn't mention is that this was coming up, and part of the sense of urgency was we were getting close to the 60th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. How's that for a marketing hook? Here's this woman who was killed right after the D-Day invasion. We're coming up to this historical incident. The entire world is going to be paying attention to this topic. He has an unusual, unexpected take on the topic. Okay? So, I still don't know how he did it, but by just sheer force of will and cold calling and everything else, he manages to talk his own way onto Good Morning America. He also, in the course of interviewing the remaining members of this young nurse's regiment, they're still alive, he managed to pull together a reunion meal, a dinner at a mansion overlooking the Potomac the night before the D-Day ceremonies. Nice marketing hook, right? Beyond, this is me talking like a business tool, it's also a remarkable incident, a remarkable event. So he did all this on his own. The book got enormous attention, did quite well, went into paperback. We actually did a movie deal. Like most movies deals, it never ended up in an actual movie, but you pocket the money, it's great. So, you know, this funnel gets even more and more narrow when you're talking movie deals. But it was a grand success. So he went from frenzy to hope to success to disaster, on back up again to success. And all of it, almost all of it, was because he didn't give up. He kept at it. He came a long way on his own, flying himself to go do research for this project. That was money out of pocket. He had faith in the project. He put himself out there. He pushed his way along. And when he got this horrible outcome, or I'm still not even sure if the folks at Simon & Schuster actually even stapled review copies correctly into padded mailers. I mean, they did nothing for him, but he made it happen. So he was depressed at times, but still managed to make it a great success. Really good guy, and you should read his column in the local paper. Bob Welch, it's called American Nightingale. Wonderful book. So, news hooks. I have another client who's got a book coming out this fall called The Interloper, and it's all about Lee Harvey Oswald and his time in the Soviet Union, where he lived before coming back to the States and killing John F. Kennedy. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's killing. I don't love having that as a news hook, but it's a really interesting news hook. Everyone's going to be talking about Kennedy. Peter's got a really interesting take on the actual the killer. We're very confident that book's going to be a big success.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, all of this plays into, again, you're writing a business plan. And you have to be ready for the ebbs and flows, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. You need to have a committee. You need to have a psychotherapist. You need to have a masseuse, a pedicurist, especially you gentlemen in back, whatever it takes. You know, there aren't rules to this. There are general heuristics. It's a ridiculous industry. I try to talk people out of it all the time, and I don't say that jokingly. But these are the elements that are going to give you the best chance of success. In terms of other information resources, down at the bottom, self-publishing boot camp. A woman named Carla King teaches workshops and also sells the book that goes with the workshops. I highly recommend it. Even if you're not going self-publishing, some of the stuff is about page layouts and doing covers, but a lot of the other elements are all about the things that are true, whether you're doing it yourself or if you're working yourself through this entire chain. So check out the website. I really recommend the book. This book proposal bootcamp and a parallel but somewhat different talk called The Business of Publishing are available for free on my website. So if for some reason you'd missed something today, feel free to go back, and it's great if you're having trouble sleeping. The best websites for the industry, the best one singly, is if you're looking for an agent. Publishers Marketplace. You pay, it's $25 a month. It has a database of book deals. Not every book deal, but a big proportion of the book deals that have been done over the past decade. And you can search, say you're pitching a paranormal teen thriller. You can sort all the deals and say, hey, look, I'm starting to see this agent appears again and again and again. So when you start pitching, it's a great way to figure out who you might want to pitch. The other amazing resource is out there at the Barnes & Noble booth. Please go buy it. Jeff Herman's Guide to Editors and Agents. The reason why that's better than Writer's Market, he interviews each of us. And so it's two or three pages where you get a sense for what we're all about. This is a personal business. When you start pitching agents, it's great that we had one-on-one time, but one, have a premise, and two, have a sense for who these people are. This is a very personal business.
And which was that?
Jeff Herman's Guide to Editors and Agents. That and Publishers Marketplace are the two best resources for finding an agent. The other one is also reading the acknowledgments section in books that are similar to yours. we work for money, we live for acknowledgments. And if somebody says something nice about their agent, and it's a book like yours, again, that's a great opening in your letter. I see that authors A, B, and C said good things about you. Here's why I should be the fourth in that list of authors in this area. Publishers Weekly and Galleycat are all about publishing news. I'm sometimes reluctant to even include those here because the last thing you need to do is worry about publishing news. But for a little bit of context, it can give you a good sense of things. We've got another 10 minutes, but that's the big picture. I see a few vague smiles, so I guess you're not as depressed as you were 20 minutes ago, which is fine. Let me answer some more questions. Yes?
When somebody submits a query letter and a proposal tool, how long do you expect to have sort of exclusive look at this? You said you don't like it when it's coming to you in the world.
The question is,
vary from person to person.
Yeah, how long do we want an exclusive look? And the answer is never. And there are no exclusive looks at the beginning. That if you went one agent at a time, you'd be 900 years old by the time you heard back from everybody. Multiple submissions are the way we do it. We send out to all the target editors at once. You should send to at least a core of your target agents at once. The point of an exclusive later is if you send a query, just a letter, for example, I may say, ooh, this is really interesting. I'd love an exclusive look at it for a defined period of time. And a week. Is an appropriate amount of time. Basically, it's a trade-off saying, I want an exclusive look, but I promise to get back to you very quickly. But if you're sending a full packet to everybody, because that's what folks ask for on their websites, then at that point, there is no such thing as an exclusive. You want to find out, hey, who's interested in your project? If you get someone who calls you day one or day 60 and says, I'd like to represent this, it's perfectly legit at that point to say, give me some time to think about it. And for you to contact everybody else and say, hey, I've gotten an offer of representation just to give you a heads up. You may not hear back from a lot of the folks, or some people may say, ooh, I got to get to that. And you may have multiple people who want to represent you.
And then how long do you give them to get back to you?
To get back to you, like I say, it's about a week is an appropriate period of time. More than that is extravagant. Less than that is, you know, we're all busy working for a living. So a week is legit, maybe two, and not much more than that. Question?
An agent of a very reputable agency told me publishers, editors no longer edit. They're too busy talking to the salespeople. Mm-hmm. And this person identified himself as a developmental editor for the agency. Mm-hmm. How common is that?
The question is about do editors edit broadly? And there are some editors who are really just business people and all they do is acquire and they let someone else edit it. There are some editors that are brilliant and still do deep editing of a manuscript. And that's part of what we're there for, to help understand what are the differences. Sometimes, I've worked for very long periods of time with some clients shaping their proposal. It could be editing their sample chapter. It could be just helping them shape the detail table of contents because the architecture wasn't there yet. There is no one right answer. And as you query agents and you start to get replies back, that's a conversation to have. What do you think needs to change here? And what help are you going to offer on that? People come to agenting from very different realms, some from the editorial realm, some from the pure deal-making realm, some directly from prison. It's all over the map. So these are the questions to ask, again, because it's a very personal business. Yeah?
What do you think of, say, professional editors who charge, say, $1,000 to edit your book before you talk to an agent?
The question is about professional editors. There are many great professional editors, and I've worked with some at early stages before something goes to publishers, also at stages after we get a deal, and yet the author says they need more help than that publishing firm is going to provide. My hesitation with any professional editor is, as I said earlier today, they have an incentive to take your money as opposed to being in a writing group. So start with a writing group. Getting free feedback, giving free feedback, that's the fair trade. Now, the other part is it's hard to vet professional editors. So like with any other hiring of a professional, you're going to want to find out what are their credentials, who have they worked with, what success have they had, and when they look at your work, if you say, I'm looking for an editor, what do you think, listen to what they have to say. If what they're saying resonates with you and they show examples of how they did it, great. If not, hey, it was nice to meet you. I'm going to keep looking for somebody else. But I always advocate first stop, and often usually last stop, is a writing group where you're trading time for editing as opposed to paying somebody where the incentives can be a little bit messy and where it's very hard to vet someone's success and talent. So, some other questions? Yeah.
Any common mistakes that you see in book proposals?
Any common mistakes in book proposals? How much time you got? No, this is about professionalism. And again, as I said before, the fact that you're here puts you head and shoulders above most folks that are writing and most folks that are querying agencies. You know, you're spending time and money. And a Saturday, it's nice out. What are you doing here? You're crazy. Get out of here. I could detail the mistakes other people make. I guarantee those aren't going to be the mistakes you make. Treat it like a professional document. Treat it like the start of a potential professional relationship. You're doing everything right. Yeah.
And you still do the same order. You query first, and then you would say, hey, let me see your book proposal.
The, the question is, what should you be querying with? And this is one where the most common mistake, folks who don't read our websites. Every agent's different. Some will say, only send me a page. Some will say, send me your full proposal. Some, I don't particularly care. Every agency is different. Write each of us in a personal way so that it's a letter. Hey, I think this might be a nice match, and I'm delivering to you what you say you'd like to see first.
And would you I see.
Agencies aren't shy about telling you exactly what they want to see. So read every website carefully first. Writer's Digest, one of the other reasons why I hate Writer's Market, they published my personal email address this past year. It was an intern screw-up. So I keep getting these wacky things where it says on my website, you know, this is how I want to be approached. So that, by definition, I delete those because that's someone who couldn't even be bothered to read my website. Even if they had my email address, still go read the website. That's where I tell you what I care about. So... all the way in back.
If you don't have a platform, what are like the first few steps you should start to...
The notion of starting a platform, it's going to vary wildly depending on what it is you're working on. And so you've got to say to yourself, think like a marketer and not so much I'm building platform for its own sake. But if, again, if you were self-publishing, how would you get the word out? How would you get famous among your core target audience in a way that they're going to say, oh, this person's good, and I want to spend money for their insights or their storytelling or whatever else it is, there's not going to be one right answer. So, yeah.
One of the people in my little writing group, she asked me for advice, and I wasn't sure what to say, so I might just throw it out to you. She did have an agent, and they worked together for 2 years, I think she said, and the agent really didn't do much, you know, she sent things out there, but you know, it kept passing, and it was nonfiction, and the agent, because she refused to give up, the author or writer refused to give up, but the agent kind of said, you know what, I've done everything after 2 years, you know, that's it, and so she kind of dumped her, and so you talked about never giving up, and you know. She was saying, well, I think I'm done. You know, I'm just done. You know, I'm gonna
not
give
every
up.
Project sells. So, and so you can work with an agent as with an editor, and there may be, at a certain point, no success.
Right.
And there is no one right answer. You may say, you know, we all have these stories, like Bob, my client Bob Welch, 26 other agents rejected him, and he stuck with it. I've had projects where I've pitched, it's not going anywhere. Sometimes I say to the author, you know what? I was wrong. The market has told me this doesn't have potential. Other times, I'll say, no, they're full of it, they're wrong, and I'm going to keep with it, and we'll eventually sell it. There are no rules to this. There is no right answer.
So you still stick with...
Sometimes I'll stick with clients. No, for an author, never give up.
Because it's going to get to a point where, you know, she's like, well, I.
Only you can say if it's time to give up. Not every project's going to succeed. That's okay. You know, sometimes you have to throw away that souffle. So, sir?
Is it a waste of time to finish the book without having to, you know, sold up?
That's a great question. Should you go ahead and finish the book if it's not sold? And I would say do it if you want to, but if you're pitching a project, focus on that proposal, and you're going to get some great feedback. And maybe you're going to reconfigure entirely based upon feedback from an editor. One of the reasons I like selling proposals as opposed to finished book to editors, because then they can, the ones that are still editing, many of them, get a chance to get in there and monkey with it and shape it in their own way, which is human ego, and hopefully they've got some expertise. So the more you can get other people's expertise at every stage, the better. If you feel compelled to write it, great, go ahead. Certainly continue your research, continue your writing, your notes, and everything else. But if you're in process pitching, make that a research stage. Don't continue writing the manuscript unless your editor, sorry, your agent is so convinced you've got it exactly right. Yeah.
What's the average amount of time between a publishing deal or the book proposal being accepted by a publisher and when you need to finish the book?
The question is how soon do you need to finish the book after you get a deal? And the rough sense is, about a year. But that's not generally driven by anything other than what makes sense for the author. Publishers aren't going to want to give you 3-4 years because you've taken their money. And they don't want it sitting out there. And I've got a client, he's nuts. I just did a book deal for him with Harvard Business Press. And I said, when are you going to finish the book? He said, I'll be done by September. What? He claims you can get the whole thing done in 7 more weeks. That's a bit crazy, although he's done a lot of the writing in his own head, so maybe. But it's really, how long is it going to take? Be honest with yourself, then be honest with your agent, and then that can be part of the conversation around the book deal. So, yeah.
I'm generally a fiction writer, but I'm writing this nonfiction book that this agent was very interested in at the conference. And so if she actually got me a deal for this book, this is all hypothetical, I have to write the proposal, which is why I came to class, but how much of an advance do people actually get enough to live on that I can work full time on this book?
The question is how big are advances? And the notion of can you live on an advance, almost invariably the answer is no. If you're in this for the money, I'm in this for the money, you shouldn't be in this for the money in the short term. If you're going to make a living off your writing, we really need to talk. It's not going to work. You're also, any advance, you're not going to get all of it up front. You're only going to get a third or a quarter up front. Agent's going to take their piece. The feds are going to take their piece. I don't know if you have income tax in Oregon. Anyway, it's not going to be, don't do this for the advance. And the question, you raise a very interesting point, where self-publishing is different from traditional publishing. In self-publishing, there's no advance, so you got to find a way to do the whole book on your own. Novelists, you can get up at 5 a.m. If you're doing a journalistic book, where you need to be awake and available from 9 a.m. till noon to call people, much harder to do. And in this day and age, that's actually a big risk to investigative journalism, because it's that much harder to get big enough advances to support somebody while they pay their mortgage and their health insurance and their kids' school tuition. It's a real problem. So I don't have any good answer, any positive answers on that, except assume you're going to get almost no advance. Even if it's a nice amount, bank it. Don't live on it, because you're going to want to save that for publicity and other things. So, sorry, that was a good grimace. Great. Yes, and back. No? Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. The question is about co-authors, and generally a subject matter expert is going to be the one who goes out and publicizes and is going to be the one who gets on, not Oprah, on Charlie Rose or Terry Gross. And the co-author is just a hired hand to write the words. That person can have their name on the cover, or they could be literally invisible or anything in between. And those kinds of relationships come up all kinds of different ways. So if you're a great writer, you can go out and find subject matter experts. I have a client who just co-writes for a living, not just Sarah Warnick, but some others. Or you may have an opportunity there. Or you may be a guru and you need to find the right co-author. There aren't rules to this. There's lots of ways financially you could set up the collaboration. But by and large, it's the expert who's the face for once the book is published. And they may only contribute their notes and some conversation to the actual writing of the book.
Who are you? Who's your client?
I represent the team. So I don't match the two. I will give, if I have a subject matter expert as a client, I will introduce them to 3 prospective co-authors. They choose. They need to negotiate their own deal. Then legally, I represent them as a team. So we have time for a half a question. Yes.
As far as the detailed chapter summaries go, mm-hmm. I have kept, just for my own use, a story points for each chapter, at least 10 story points. This has to happen. Is that detailed enough? Mm-hmm.
The question is how much detail? And there isn't a single right answer, but the fact that you've got 10 story points in every chapter tells me you have really thought through what's going in these chapters. That level of detail sounds great. So I'm going to stop now. You guys are vaguely smiling probably because you can get out of here now. So thank you for coming.
Can I ask you?
Now we're going to bombard you.
Yeah, we're going to bombard you.